will, open up to the book of Job. And if you're looking at your outline, one little correction that will be made there, you'll see that the Roman numeral says the speeches or something like that. And that's just because I did a little bad pasting, copying and pasting, and didn't realize until I got it over here. Should read point number Roman numeral 6 and doctrinal themes in Job, and hopefully there are no other typos. But we are going to begin, as we round out this study. I said we'd do an overview of the book, not a verse-by-verse study, of course. But we are going to look at several doctrinal themes within the book. And tonight, we will start, if you'll look at chapter 4 and verse 7, we'll start there, and we'll start with a question that Eliphaz poses. That is a recurring theme, maybe the central theme of the book, and we'll kind of deal with it. I do want to make a comment or two before I begin. First of all, I've been asked to express appreciation to everyone here who's been offering a number of prayers. And I'll add my personal comments. Quite a number of you called and expressed concern about my family, our families. Of course, Wes is from there too, as he told you. And appreciate that. Appreciate all the prayers that have been offered in their behalf, and they do as well. So my parents ask that I convey that, and I'll pass that along to you. Secondly, glad to have Wes here. That was an excellent job that he did this morning, and I really look forward to the year that we'll spend together here, and looking forward to being with him, getting to know him better, have heard about him, at least, maybe seen him a couple of times through the years, but really heard about him a lot as he was growing up. And so it's going to be good to get to know him better. I've been told by one of his close friends down south that I'm going to really enjoy getting to know him, so I'll take his word at that at face value. Without any further delay, Eliphaz asks the question, if you look at chapter 4 and verse 7, Job has finished what we looked at last Sunday. The fact that Job bemoans what Kenny read for us a moment ago, that Job bemoans, curses the day he was born, wishes maybe beyond that that he had died at birth. Finally, as he will say several times in the book, he wishes he could just die. That things are that bad, he's reached the limit of what he would like to bear in life, what he wishes he had to bear in life. Doesn't understand it. We're going to really look at that. We're going to dig into that, his whole questioning of God, and perhaps what people who go through very severe trials on this earth, as they themselves question God, we're going to look at all of that. But Eliphaz attempts to answer, and really Eliphaz will be like a broken record in the book, and I'm not going to look at every verse of that in which he does this, but he asks the question, if you look at verse 7. He says to Job, "Remember, I pray thee, whoever perished being innocent." So we begin to ask the question, why do bad things, as we look at them, and we always do, if things like this happen, we would certainly feel they're bad things. Why do bad things happen to good people? No one would doubt that Job is a good person. No one would read his description in the first two chapters and say Job is less than a good person. In fact, he's exemplary. He's the best of the best by God's own admission. So why do bad things happen to good people? It's a good question. It's a question that you want to ask and you want to try to answer. Eliphaz's position about it is a very common position. A very common, what I'll say, is a misconception. For Eliphaz asked in Job 4 and verse 7, why do bad things happen to good people? Well, Job, I'll put it back to you. Try to remember in your life, whoever perished. The word is the idea of being destroyed. Some translations put it that way. Whoever destroyed, being innocent. You can't be innocent. If you try to maintain your innocence, and later in the book we will really see this, but if you try to maintain your innocence, I will quickly charge you, you can't be. Because all of this has happened to you. Where did you ever in your life see the righteous, and you would consider yourself righteous, Job, Where did you ever see the righteous, notice the phrase, cut off? It's a common misconception. Turn over to John chapter 9, if you will. Remember that story there when Jesus was escaping the stoning? You can see that at the latter part of chapter 8. And it says, as Jesus passed by, he saw a man that was blind from his birth. And the disciples began to immediately question Jesus. Now, they can only reason if somebody is born blind, then something happened. And so they asked Jesus, who sinned? Notice that's their only reason for someone to be blind. And certainly to be blind as long as this young man has been. Who sinned? Did his parents sin? Did somehow he sin, which doesn't even make any sense? Did he sin in the womb or whatever? But who sinned so that this would happen? And you'll notice Jesus answers that as if to say, you're mistaken, you're wrong, you have a false conception about the reason of things like this happening. This man was born blind, he is blind, for this very purpose, this day that you're about to see. And then he goes on to say, if you're looking at the passage in verses 4 and 5, I was sent to do the works of God, I must work the works of God while it is day, etc. So it's very evident that man has a misconception that every bad thing that ever happens, it happens because somebody sins. We see it, Eliphaz saying it, we see his two companions saying it, we see the charges being made to Job, and yet we've already explored the fact that that can't be so. That's not what we see in chapters 1 and 2. Wes reiterated that this morning. It's not what we see in those two chapters. We know that all that happened was at the disposal of God. Yes, it was affected through Satan, but it was at the disposal of God, and there was purpose. In fact, there are several purposes to what happened. We're not going to really go back into all of this. We've looked at it, but let me list them for you quickly. One, and perhaps some would say the major purpose. I don't say that, but one purpose was to repudiate Satan. To absolutely expose Satan for what he is. He maligns, he accuses, he slanders, he is Satan, and he's a liar. As Jesus says in John chapter 8, he was a liar from the beginning. So it repudiates Satan and his position about man. Take away everything he has. He'll curse you to your face. Touch his body, and surely he will curse you. Well, it repudiates Satan. But more than that, and I really think most importantly in the book, not everyone would agree with this, but I think most importantly in the book, it is to test Job, yes, to prove Job, have you considered my servant Job? But I think more than anything, I'm convinced the more study I do of the book as years go by, that it is to reprove Job. That in other words, what you have in Job, and I've said this before, and I'll mention it briefly and go on, but what you have in Job is a really, really good guy with a fatal flaw. Now, not a fatal flaw that's exposed itself, not a fatal flaw that has yet come to fruition, not a fatal flaw that has yet proven to be a problem in Job, but it will. And given the test, many people would look at this whole book and look at this whole story and just be very quick to say, especially disregarding all these speeches that we're now wading through, they'd be quick to say, Job was a perfect man. He was tested, you know, to the fullest limits of anything anybody ever went through, maybe except for Jesus, and he passed the test, and kind of leave it at that. Well, that'd be wrong. He didn't. And in fact, what happened with Job is that Job was exposed. It exposed it to himself, and that's the most important thing. This trial exposed to him the flaw he had that would have been fatal to his soul. It reproved Job, brought him to a point where he was much better for having gone through this, and he was corrected. And as we look at the book, we will see Job in his confusion. We'll see God in his exposing of Job, etc., etc., but we will see that. Now, finally, it is for the growth of Job, but it is also, as you look at these speeches, and especially as you get to the end of the book and you see and we're allowed to see the whole story, it also brings to light this great misconception. And people still have it. You would think with everything that the Bible has to say, and in fact, if indeed this is the first book of the Bible, God just started with this misconception that man has, and once and forever dealt with it, but he didn't. Obviously, the disciples still have the misconception, and people today too. I can't tell you the number of times in life when something has happened, some bad thing, quote unquote, has happened, and immediately someone will begin to say, why is this happening? And a humble person, a Christian, will almost immediately begin to say, I don't know what I'm doing wrong. I don't know what's wrong in my life. I don't know what I've done, but this is happening, so I must have done something wrong. We're going to explore this a little bit further tonight, and I think we'll see that's just not always the case. It can be, but it doesn't have to be. So it exposes this false concept, deals with these three friends, and they, together with Job, we see at the end of the book, they certainly repent. We often hear people talk about, well, Job repented and was very humble and repented at the end. We hear people say that, but rarely do you ever hear anyone say, and the three repented. But they do. And you can definitely see that in chapter 42. So there were a number of things, a number of reasons, and that gets us to the point of looking at God. And we begin to realize just how immense God is. God has the ability to overview the world, to overlook the world, and see every need that needs to be fulfilled. And to bring people together, to bring situations together, even to use Satan himself to accomplish the greater needs and to help people. And I think Wes mentioned it this morning in 1 Peter 1 and did an excellent job with that. But to bring people to the point of refining them so that they come out of it shining like gold, as he said. And that's true. And they are much better for having gone through it. That's the providence of God. When we talk about the providence of God, we talk about God recognizing a need and fulfilling. We talk about God's caretaking, God's caregiving. We talk about the fact that God is sovereign, absolutely sovereign. He is in control of everything. Satan is always there. Satan will always be in the background to accuse us and to lie about us and to do all of these things against us that he does. Yes, he is that roaring lion stalking about, but God is sovereign. And when you read a book like the book of Job, you come away from it realizing that what God is saying, and he is saying it, loudly and clearly, I am in control. There's never been a moment when I haven't been in control. You've questioned me, Job. We'll get to that. You've questioned me. You've wondered at it. Your friends have been mistaken about me. They don't understand me as no human being fully understands God. But one thing we know, God is sovereign. I want us to look at some of the things that the book tells us about God in his sovereignty. One, we've already seen this, and that is that God must permit everything that happens. We'll look at a number of passages, and I'd like for you to read a couple of them with me. I'm going to go to the book of Ecclesiastes several times tonight. But look at Ecclesiastes chapter 9, and notice something that it says here. The wise man, I agree with Wes, I think this is Solomon that wrote the book. But I think Solomon is saying here, as he looks at man and everything man goes through, etc. And he says, for all this I considered in my heart, even to declare all this, that the righteous and the wise and their works are in the hands of God. God is absolutely sovereign. Anything that I do, any work that I commit, that I effect, or whatever, is by the permission of God. If God doesn't want it to happen, it won't happen. And no matter how much I stand up in my arrogance and defy God and say, I will do this and I will do that, I won't do it unless God permits it. Nor will you, nor will even Satan himself. And so we have seen Satan go to God and ask permission to do what he does. That's an astounding thing, really, when you think about it. That everything is by the permission of God. Now, do I understand all of that? No. Do I understand? I mean, the person begins to ponder that, and I remember 9/11 and people pondering that very question. and say, you mean God allowed this? Christians believe that. Don't you believe that God is in control? Sure, I believe it. Don't you believe God could have stopped it? Well, sure, I believe that. Then why didn't he? Do you think I have all the answers to all those kinds of questions? Of course not. But then I'm not in the mind of God. We're going to look at some passages, not tonight, but where the very wisdom of God is questioned. Where these three and Job begin to consider the wisdom of God. Why God does what he does. I think it's futile of man to even ask that question, but they do ask it. And they consider it, and so we will as well. But it is true, by passages like this, and certainly what we see in Job 1 and 2, I mean, we've seen that. Everything is done by the permission of God. Second point that I think you see in the book is that God sets all the limits. Those two really are two ways of saying the same thing. I mean, if God permits, then he doesn't permit certain things, so he sets the boundaries, he sets the limits. But God sets all the limits. We've already looked at 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 13. He will not allow, that's the permission, he will not allow us to be tempted above that we are able, or above what we are able. That's the limits. Everybody has a limit. You have one. I have one. We don't always know it. You know, we hear people saying, I could never go through that. Something happens to somebody, I couldn't go through that. If that happened to me, I don't know what I would do. Oh, you don't. And if you can't go through it, God knows that. And it won't happen to you. You won't go through it. But if you can go through it, and especially if it is what is needed that you go through it, then you will go through it. God will not only permit it, but God will bring it to pass. But he will set the limits, and it will never be more than I'm able. So when I find myself saying, and I have found myself saying this, not just to myself or to others, but to God, just as Job does, many times in this book, it's too much. You put too much on me, it's too much. I can't do it. I don't want to do it. Now, those are two different things. In chapter 3, we see him saying, I don't want to do it. He will come to a point of saying he cannot do it, but he can. Then he will come back to saying, I must be able to do it because I'm doing it. You know? And I think maybe all of us, certainly some of us, have felt that very kind of thing. There's been something in life we never thought we could go through. We went through it. And no matter how badly we endured it, let's not even talk about that for a moment. Let's just talk about the fact that we endured it. We're still here. I mean, if you ever went through something like that and you're still here, then you endured it. And the truth is, Job is enduring something like that. So God sets the limits. When you get close to, and I guess in mathematical terms, but we used to argue this in calculus classes and so forth, but you know, the idea of a limit, and those of you in math will understand this, the idea of a limit, do you reach, you know, like a frog is going to jump half the distance to the wall and then half the distance and then half the distance infinitely. Is it going to reach the wall? Well, you argue that all day long. But I'll tell you this. If the wall over there is the limit that I can go through, then halfway to the limit is bad. Three quarters of the way to the wall is really bad. When it starts getting to that 999/100 close to the wall, I've about had all I want to take. And I know how we feel. We feel that. And it doesn't matter, God, if you've set the limit, and the limit is the wall, if I'm shoved right up against it, I feel that. And I've had a lot. So Job is saying in this book, if this is the limit, then I just want to die. Because I don't want to suffer. And I think that's fair. I don't think that's wrong to say that. And I don't condemn Job for that. A little point about God's sovereignty, though, and what a righteous person like Job, or a Christian like you and I, what we have to realize is God is accomplishing his purpose. Now, we've read, and I'm not going to turn back to 1 Peter 5 and reread and restudy. The idea there, if you notice, in verses 8 through 10, where God says by inspiration, what your brethren are going through. Notice the word accomplish is there. It's being accomplished in your brethren. God accomplishes His purpose or His purposes by what is done. I want you to go back with me, if you will, or you may still be there. But look at the book of Ecclesiastes. I'm going to go to chapter 8 this time. And an interesting thing that Solomon says here. In Ecclesiastes 8, and drop down with me to verse 6. Solomon says, because to every purpose there is time and judgment. Notice that. To every purpose there is time and judgment. And therefore the misery of man is great upon him. Now, I think this is very descriptive of a trial like Job is going through. But look at verse 7. For he knoweth not, that is man. Man knoweth not that which shall be. But who does? Some of you are mouthing God. You're right. We don't know. I don't know. You don't know. Especially when I'm going through it, I can't even see clearly to think about it. But God does. He knoweth not, man knows not what shall be. For who can tell him when it shall be? Or what shall be, some translations say. Nobody could. But God knows. God accomplishes His purpose. In fact, if you're looking at verse 7, interestingly enough, and I don't know if you have a translation that bears this out, but literally in the original, word for word, this is what it says. Man doesn't know what shall be. Who can tell him when it shall be? Or literally, who can tell him how it will turn out? Who knows how it will turn out? God does. I'm convinced that when God looked at this whole situation, and I take this from the things God says at the end of the book. When God looked at this whole situation, I believe God knew the perfect Job with the fatal flaw. Now, I realize that doesn't sound correct. But he was perfect because he had not yet failed. He hadn't failed, that is, his flaw hadn't been exposed. You know, you understand that. I understand that. I might have a piece of machinery. It's got a flaw in it. Doesn't mean it's broken yet, but it will as time goes on. Job would have broken. And God uses this, and I believe God was able to look at Job, know his heart, put this limit of testing on Job, knowing Job would not pass it perfectly, but knowing in the end, Job would be much better and he would be corrected having gone through it. God knows how it will turn out. And that's very important. Look with me also, if you will, if you're in the book of Ecclesiastes, go back to chapter 6. And look at verses 11 and 12. Very interestingly here. Solomon says, seeing there be many things that increase vanity, foolishness, profitlessness, what is man the better? If all these things are going to happen in life that just kind of beat you down, beat you up in our application of the passage tonight, if these things are just going to drag you down, beat you up, put you in a position where you're like Job, you know, questioning God, challenging God, defying God almost at a certain point in the book, then how is man better off for going through all this? How is it that I'm better off? And sometimes I want to look up at heaven and say, I know you're in control of everything, and I know you must find a purpose, a reason for me to go through this, but how can I be better off for this? I'm not doing too well in it. I'm not doing too well while I suffer it. You know, I'm not that super Christian that responds to everything that's happening to me in a perfect way. So how am I better? Well, look at verse 12. Who knows what is good for man in this life? I think I know. I always think I know what's good for me. And so do you. I mean, we would make different choices. We would do different things. Sometimes we wouldn't. But the truth is, in an overall sense, most people, if they're rationally thinking and so forth, try to protect themselves, try to give themselves at least what will make them happy or feel good or whatever. And it all boils down to what you, at least at the moment, think is good for you. But who really knows what is good for you? God does. And if God says to me in His sovereignty, if God says to me, Michael, what is good for you is for you to suffer this and this and this and this and this right behind it, as Job did.
and to push you to the wall, to push you to the limit. If I say that is good for you, it's good for you. It's what you need. So who knows what is good for man in this life, all the days of his vain life, which he spends as a shadow? Who can tell a man what shall be after him under the sun? All of these questions that Solomon poses, he answers in one fell swoop at the end of the book. God! God can tell him. God knows. It's a rhetorical question that only and can only have one answer. So as I look at this, I realize that God is making a sovereign decision about me, about Job in the book, to do what is best for him so he'll be better. How can you know what God has planned for you? How can you know the determined outcome? And there is one. Go over to Romans 8 for a minute and look at this passage maybe in a little different light. I remember arguing with Professor Fink. Some of you, if you look carefully at the opening credits of your Bible, you may find a guy by the name of Paul Fink. And I was privileged, or not, to have him as one of my professors. But I can remember about this passage. Now, he was a Calvinist, and he believed in predestination. And he asked me, he challenged me in class one day about predestination. And I said, yeah, I do believe in it. I believe in Romans 8 very clearly. Romans 8 talks about predestination. But notice what God says here very carefully. We often quote verse 28. We know, Christians do know, that all things work together for good. Why? Well, because God is able to do that. He's able to make everything work out for good, right? I mean, that's what we believe about it, and we look at it. And it's true. We know that all things work together for good to them that love God. Notice as he goes on here, though. To them who are the called according to his purpose. Now, read verses 29 and 30 with it, because they go with it. Paul starts verse 29 with a very important word. I'd circle it if you write in your Bible. The word is for. For whom he did foreknow, he also did predestinate. So do we believe in predestination? Well, if you mean in eternity past, God looked down the road and said, I'm going to save Michael, but I'm not going to save Montel. No. God never did that. But I tell you what he did. God predetermined, predestined, if you will, that every single individual who would ever be called, who would ever love him and choose to do that, who would ever come to him as a Christian and live his life for him, that he would help to shape them, mold them. And if you look at verse 29, you can see what God is doing. For whom he did foreknow, he did predestinate, notice, to be conformed to the image of his son. Now, when you conform something, it has to do, and obviously when we're talking about not an inanimate object, but we're talking about us, we're animate objects. An inanimate object, when you conform it, or you form it together is what it literally means. You work on it, you know, mold it, shape it like clay, like a sculpture. But we're not inanimate objects, we're animate. And the idea in Scripture is that God is the potter and we're the clay. But the clay in this case can say no. And the clay in this case can volunteer. Or the clay in this case can choose to not be shaped. But if you choose, if you allow God to work on you, there's a kid's song, I don't know if any of you know this, but there's a children's gospel song that was very popular about 20 years ago, and it says, he's still working on me. I don't know if any of you know that song or not. It was very cute, but it made a profound point. And the point was, God is working on me. Now notice this passage. To be conformed to the image of his son, that he might be the firstborn among many brethren. Moreover, whom he did predestinate, them he also called. Whom he called, them he also justified. Whom he justified, them he also glorified. The word justified means to be made right. In the book of Job, Job is going to ponder justice and justification many times. And basically, he's going to ask the question, and his friends are going to ask it. Because his friends are going to approach it from the standpoint that too many human beings do, and that is, the only way to be justified in the sight of God is to be perfect. To never make any mistakes. To never be flawed at all. And it's impossible. You get to an arrogant point, some people do, and they become so arrogant they believe they're not flawed. Nothing wrong with me. In fact, in the sight of God, I'm perfectly justified. And you're in trouble. And Job has that problem. Now, he doesn't have it in the beginning, and he doesn't have it to the point that maybe others do, but he gets to the point of defending himself so much that he says those things. And God basically says to him, wait a minute, Jack. Who do you think you are? What do you think you are? You need me. You are not perfect. You're far from it. And you need me to work on you like a mess of clay and mold you, conform you into what can stand before me justified. That's the predestination of God. He predetermined to work on every single person that ever chooses to love and obey. When you go through this book, you see then God accomplishes His purpose. You see God's intention to mold and shape Job. And you see Job justified by his works. Interestingly enough, I'm not going to take a lot of time to explore this, but when you talk about the idea of being justified by faith and works, have you ever stopped to think about the examples the Bible uses? Now I know, and I've done this many times myself. I turn to the passage and I say we're justified by faith, and I turn to the other one and I say we're justified by works. And sometimes I get to the point, and especially early in preaching, I would get to the point where I start listing the things that we do, the works we do, you know. You go to church, you're baptized, you go to church, you take the Lord's Supper, all that. But have you ever noticed that the works that God cites are works like that? It's never the mundane, everyday Christian works you do. God never cites those things and says, you're justified by your works. Now, as a matter of fact, look carefully at James chapter 2 for a moment. I'm quoting it here. You can look up here, look in your Bible, at your translation. But notice the word that I emphasized. Was not Abraham our father justified by works, James asks? We know he was. But was not he justified by works? Notice the phrase. When he had offered Isaac his son upon the altar. What's it say? That's saying, like Job, the righteous are saved with difficulty. 1 Peter 4:18. That's saying, like Job, God justifies us not just for the simplest of things we do and leave it at that. Not just for the everyday commandments that we check off in a checklist and say, well, God says do this and I've done that. 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 That's a rich young ruler. Checking off the Ten Commandments. I don't lie, I don't commit adultery, I do right by my parents, etc. All this have I done from my youth up. Well, that's not what justifies you. What justifies you is when you're willing to go the last step. The test. The trial. For Abraham, it was to offer Isaac. For Job, it was to lose everything. For the rich young ruler, it was to sell everything he had, give it away to the poor, and come and follow Jesus. For you, you fill in the blank. For me, I fill in the blank. That's when I parallel passages like James 2:21. And I'm justified by my works. And we see God accomplishing that through His sovereignty in this book. Everybody suffers. Everybody goes through trouble. But God uses it. And God uses it to save the righteous with that difficulty, with that trouble. Now let's go back to Eliphaz's point. And let's just, in the last couple of minutes, let's make sure we understand that that is a misconception to say bad things happen because people sin. They do sometimes. Eliphaz is right. Sometimes, but not always. So when we look at this question in Eliphaz's question in Job chapter 4, did you ever see the righteous cut off? Well, I have. Have you? You ever seen a righteous person? I mean, someone you just knew was righteous and faithful as far as anybody could ever tell. You knew they were righteous, and yet they suffer. They seem to do without things they need. They're hurt in this life. They lose something or many things precious. Have you ever seen that? Have you ever been through that? Well, if you have, then you would look at Eliphaz and say, yes, you know, because that's what Job does. When did you ever see the righteous cut off? If I were Job sitting there, I would say, right now, look, right now, I see it. Did the innocent ever suffer? Yeah. And that's what Job says. Spends 30 chapters saying, I'm innocent and I'm suffering. It's just that he goes too far. You know, one of the things that you have to realize, and Eliphaz even understands it. Go to Job chapter 5 for a minute. Eliphaz understands in Job chapter 5 and verse 7. Notice where he says, man is born unto trouble. Now, if you put that together with what Job will later say in the more famous Job 14 and verse 1, man that is born of woman is a few days and full of trouble. Interestingly enough, though these words are usually translated trouble, they're two different words in the original. And they're very specific words for very specific kinds of trouble. What Eliphaz is saying in his speech in chapter 5 and verse 7, you can go back to it and look at it. Man is born unto or into trouble. Eliphaz is saying the world is troubling. And it is. We are not supposed to live this life with a laugh all the time. I mean, when you look at it, for example, when you look at the picture of Judgment Day and you look at the righteous, what do you see? You see God, Jesus, wiping away the tears of the righteous. This world has a lot of trouble. And you can party it up all the time. My dad was telling me about someone he knew yesterday, house that he rents out. Didn't realize it until it was way too late. Here was this woman, you know, apparently hooked on heroin, shooting up every day. He found literally a garbage can full of hypodermic needles, used needles. That's someone that does something artificial to escape life, to escape the trouble. They don't want to face the trouble. They don't want to go through the trouble, so they use a chemical that makes them feel good. Other people do it by different means. They drink, they party, they fornicate, they do all those kinds of things. And they forget life. But man is born into trouble. And this word that Eliphaz uses here is an interesting one. It's a word that means something that wears on or wears out, wears down something. It's like the idea of a river, and Job will even use the analogy, a river that constantly runs over a rock and just wears it down over time. There's a passage in Daniel chapter 7, and I'm going to turn there, but where God will prophesy about the future of Christians as they go through Roman persecution, and he will talk about the Roman emperors, quote unquote, wearing out the saints. Trouble in life wears you out. It's one of the most tiring, defeating things there is. I mean, you can work hard all day long in a field. I've done that. The hot sun beating down on you, and it will wear you out, but it's a good kind of wearing you out. And you can go through trouble all day, shed the tears and so forth, and it will wear you out, and it's not good. And it begins to work on you inside. It wears you down inside. It beats you up, and sometimes it totally defeats people. And that's the word that Eliphaz is using. Now, Job's point in Job 14, when he says, man that is born of woman is of a few days and full of trouble. Job uses a term that may even be stronger. You might say, well, what in the world could be stronger than something that would just wear you out? Well, because Job uses a word that means something like commotion or a disquieting. Something that just upsets you completely. And isn't that the kind of trouble that we think about? The kind of trouble that we think of in life, that if I have to face that kind of trouble that affects everything in my life, like Job is going through,
That's the kind of trouble I don't know if I can make it through then. Well, that's what Job is saying here. Trouble is a natural part of life. Everybody recognizes it. No matter which term you choose to use, whether it's Eliphaz or it's Job, or the terms they use, we realize that trouble is a natural part of life. But we might ask the question, why do bad things happen to good people? Sure, it's the normal course of life, but are there any other reasons? One of the most common statements, again, going back to that misconception, is that every time bad things happen, every time trouble comes in life, it's as a result of God chastising His own people or punishing those who are not. And you will hear people, and people will come to preachers often or to, you know, very learned, righteous people, and they will say to people, "Why, you know, this is what's happening to me. Why is this happening?" And they want some profound answer to it. Because they assume many times that it's happening because of the wrong they've done, and they just don't know what they've done wrong. Look at Job chapter 5 for a moment, and that's exactly what Eliphaz assumes here. Man is born into trouble. But I tell you this, Job, down in verse 17, if you'll read it with me, I tell you this, that most of the trouble he suffers, and you'll hear people say it like this, most of the trouble he suffers, he brings on himself. So verse 17, "Behold, happy is the man whom God corrects. Therefore, Job, despise not thou the chastening of the Almighty, for He maketh sore and bindeth up. He woundeth, and His hands make whole." Now, is that a true statement? Sure it is. But is it the only reason someone can suffer? Well, no. We've already explored, and we will in the future. I'm not going to take the time tonight. But we'll look at the fact that Job is being chastised. This is happening to Job for numerous reasons. One of the ones I said at the beginning of the lesson is to correct Job. Kind of like what the writer of Hebrews says in verse 10 when he says these things are, quote unquote, for our profit, that we might be found like we're supposed to be found, to paraphrase. It's one of the reasons, but it's not the only reason. And yet, when you look at what Eliphaz says, and Bildad will come right behind him in chapter 8, and you can see verses 13 through 15 there, and some of the verses that follow, what they seem to be saying is that Job is the only reason. I mean, go back to Eliphaz's opening statement almost. I mean, almost the opening statement there. Who did you ever see that was right that suffers? Well, plenty of people. But they can't see it. All they can see is Job is sitting there in such horrendous pain. He's lost everything. Remember that long list of losses we put up last week? His wealth, his position, his integrity. Eventually he loses that, etc. He's lost that, all those things. And they look at him, and for a week, like Wes pointed out to us this morning, they sit there in silence and they look at him, and it begins to come to them, apparently, because that's all they say. It begins to come to them, nobody would go through this unless they've done something wrong. So they will say things throughout this book like, "Don't hide it, Job. Admit it. Repent of it. Whatever you've done." And they will beat on him with that. And we're going to look deeper at the kinds of things that supposed comforting companions say at times. And it teaches us some valuable lessons when we go to people and we try to help them going through these things. Things to be careful of. Things to watch out, because it's very human to fall in the trap of doing what these three, and I believe they started with great intentions, what these three ended up doing to him. But apparently they think the only reason it can happen is that, and that's just not so. It can happen for persecution. We think of Paul often saying, "Godly are persecuted." Persecution comes to Christians. Jesus said it Himself in the Beatitudes. Blessed are those who are persecuted, notice Matthew chapter 5, persecuted for righteousness' sake, not unrighteousness, righteousness' sake. Trials to strengthen you. I think that's what Job is going through, primarily, to be strengthened, to be better than he was. And finally, just a hazard in the work of God. I get you to go home tonight and read 1 Corinthians chapter 4 and 2 Corinthians chapter 1. And just listen to Paul as he talks about the hazard that he and his companions every day expose themselves to simply because they work for God. and where they are in life, how they appear to other people. Well, that's Job. Yes, he appears to them to be someone that deserves every bit of this. But they've missed it. There's far more to it than that. And we will explore that as we go on further in the book.